You're listening to
WGXC Accra,
Hudson Catskill,
90.7 FM.
Oh my God, honey, I just heard some terrible news. The radio station's going off the air.
Going off the air? How will I listen to my samba music? A 1, 2, 3, back, a 3, 2, 1, back, to the side, to the left.
Honey, you're an excellent samba dancer, but I think this is it for them.
Oh no, I just went to their website, wgxc.org. You can donate monthly, did you know that?
Yeah, you can make one of those one-time donations, but you know what I'm into? Monthly sustaining support.
Oh honey, you're very sustaining, especially when we go and have that delicious spring water in Hudson and the environs.
All right, don't get so frisky, honey. Donate monthly. Choose your amount from the drop-down menu on the old website there, or donate by check. Did you know I can give them my stuff?
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies, you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, right here on WGXC 90.7 FM in the Columbia and Greene counties of New York. In the background, you can hear the lovely sound of pages turning, because I'm going to read from a book. That's right, a book. But, not to sound all hinky or anything like that, it's true that I'm broadcasting from my smartphone. I won't say the brand because I'm not a particular fan, but I have one nonetheless. And even though I was a great cheerleader of that company for years, now I know better. But technology is a miracle, I have to say. I fried my laptop, which is the usual transmission medium or technology that I use to do this show and other things. So I was forlorn. Serendipitously, today was the open house for WGXC's Wave Farms brand new studio. Well, it's not a new building or anything, but they're taking over the lease down at 393 Main Street in Catskill, New York. Moving out of the Presbyterian Church at the corner of 4th Street and Warren in Hudson, New York, just across the river. And hope to be broadcasting from that location live by next Sunday. So there was an open house today, and I went in there and I told the lamentable tale of the frying of my laptop. I don't really think the entire laptop is fried. I think it's pretty much just the battery / power source. But I can probably get that fixed and buy a new one. Amazing. So while I was there, I was lamenting that, and I was like, oh shit, I thought there was going to be a brand new studio here from which I could broadcast my show tonight, but I guess there isn't one, and therefore I'm going to have to cancel my show. People will be sad. They'll be able to hear me say goodnight, Norman. But once again, miracle of the technological, the military-industrial complex, There is an app, and I can use it. And you can, too. You can get the app at the App Store for your smartphone and listen to WGXC 90.7 FM 24/7, 365. I think 80 years is the average age, so you can just, like, go at it. All the updates will be forthcoming. You probably won't even have to click yes or allow. I don't know. Anyways. So I got the app and has a little transmit function. Don't try this at home, kids, unless you've been given the green light from the not-so-powerful that be over at Wave Farm. And you can transmit your own radio broadcast at WGXC.org. Live on the interweb and most of the rest of the world. Tonight, a story that's nearly 1900 years old. Actually, a chapter from one of the earliest novels that survives on paper. I mean, in the West, you know, I don't know. Chinese probably got something that's 4,000 years old. But Robert Graves did not translate any of that. But there was a British guy who did do a bunch of translation of Chinese and Japanese folk tales sometime in the 19th century there. That would be the 1800s to you. And damned if I can remember his name. People complain about those translations, but nobody complains about Robert Graves, except for those who complain about him. This is his translation of Lucius Apuleius, The Golden Ass. I'm not going to read you this thing in entirety. I'm just going to cut to the chase. Lucius. It's just another ribald book, you know. I guess Rabelais. Cervant. Boccaccio. Shakespeare. They all kind of had their little ribald moments, and this is one of them. In this book, while trysting with the servant girl of a sorceress, the main character rubs a salve on himself that ostensibly will change him into a bird and whereby he will be able to take flight. But as you can imagine, the ancients were not really into the idea of individual flightiness. Witness Daedalus and Icarus. But instead of changing into a bird and flying too close to the sun, the servant girl gave him the wrong potion, and he was changed into an ass. He goes through all kinds of adventures, and here's one of the last. It's called Under the Trainer. A sudden change of fortune was awaiting me, too. The centurion who had commandeered me from the market gardener was sent to Rome by his regimental commander with dispatches for the emperor. He sold me for 11 drachmae to two brothers, kitchen slaves to a wealthy nobleman named Thyassus, who was staying in the neighborhood. One of these slaves was a confectioner, the other a cook, famous for his ragouts and sauces. They bought me as a pack beast for carrying the many kitchen utensils that Thyassus needed while he was traveling abroad. I was accepted as a third partner in their firm, and during the whole period of my transformation never had such a good time as with them. Every evening after Thyassus had dined, and he always dined in grand style, my masters used to carry back the leftover to our little room. One brought generous helpings of roast pork, chicken, fish, and similar delicacies. The other brought bread, tarts, puff pastry, twisted cheese straws, marzipan lizards, and many varieties of honey cake. But when they had locked the door and gone off to the baths to refresh themselves, I used to cram myself with the splendid food the gods had graciously put at my disposal, not being such a fool, such a complete ass, as to turn it down in favor of the coarse hay in my manger. For a long time, I was wonderfully successful in my pilfering. My technique was to take only a little from each of the many dishes on the table, knowing that my masters would never suspect an ass of playing such tricks on them. But gradually I grew overconfident and ate whatever I fancied. In fact, I picked out the best dishes and licked them clean. My masters, who began to notice their daily losses, were surprised and perplexed. And though even then it did not occur to them to fix their suspicions on me, each privately determined to find out who was the thief. They now kept a jealous watch on the dishes and counted every cake and cutlet, each eyeing the other as reproachfully as if he were a pickpocket. Finally, the cook spoke frankly and to the point. "Really, brother, I call this pretty shabby behavior. Every day for a long time now you've been stealing leftovers, always the best ones, too, selling them behind my back and then expecting me to go halves with you in what's left. If you are tired of our business partnership, let us dissolve it by all means, but continue to live together affectionately like the brothers we are. Otherwise, the friction between us will increase daily and end in a violent quarrel." "Yeah, I like that," retorted the confectioner. "By God, I like that. First you steal the stuff, then to forestall the complaints which I have been holding back patiently all this time, I was determined to put up with it as long as I could rather than accuse my own brother of being a sneak thief. You have the impertinence to accuse me. However, I'm glad that this dirty business has come out into the open. We can settle it somehow at last, instead of smothering our feelings until they finally blaze up and destroy us. You remember that play we saw about the two brothers, Eteocles and Polynices, who killed each other after a quarrel about fair shares in the government of Thebes?" These exchanges ended only when each of them had taken a solemn oath that he had not been guilty of the slightest dishonesty or taken more than his fair share of the food. They agreed to form a united front and use every possible means to discover who was robbing them. "It is out of the question, of course," one of them said, "that the ass could be the culprit. Asses don't like our sort of food." "Still, evening after evening, all the best leftovers have disappeared and only the ass has been in the room. Well, it can't be the flies." "They would have to be gigantic flies with as wide a wingspread as the harpies had, the creatures that used to rob King Phineas of his supper in the days of the Argonauts." The welcome change in my diet from fodder to human food, plenty of it too, had the effect of pumping me up, softening my tanned hide and giving my coat a handsome, silky nap. It was this that gave me away, because my masters realized that I was twice as stout as when they had bought me, though I was leaving my daily feed of hay untouched. "Handsome is as handsome does," they thought. One day they pretended to go off to the baths as usual and locked the door behind them, but peeped in through a crack and watched me making short work of the delicacies left within my reach. Forgetting all about their losses, they burst into a sudden roar of laughter at this extraordinary sight. The ass, who was a gourmet. They called a number of other slaves to take turns at the crack and watch me at my feast. Had anyone ever seen anything like it before in all his life? Their laughter was so loud and prolonged that when their master Thiasses happened to come by, he wanted to know what the joke was. They asked him to peep through the crack and see for himself. He laughed until his stomach ached, then opened the door and observed me closely. When I realized that my luck had not only held but showed signs of improvement, I went on eating quite at my ease, and the louder he laughed, the greater my self-possession. At last, fascinated by the novelty of the sight, he ordered me to be led to the supper room. No, when I come to think of it, he led me there himself. The table was already laid, and he ordered every sort of food to be put in front of me, including dishes that had not yet been touched. Although feeling pretty full already, I was anxious to oblige him in any way I could and ate everything he gave me, as if I still had a keen appetite. Thiasses and his friends were curious to find out exactly what I would eat. They thought of all the things that an ass would be most likely to loathe and offered them to me as a test of my politeness. For instance, meat seasoned with asafoetida, deviled chicken, some exotic sort of pickled fish. How the rafters of the room shook with laughter when I cleared every dish. At last, the licensed buffoon of the party asked, "Now what about a drop of wine for our guest, eh?" Not at all a bad idea, you scoundrel," said Thiasses. "I dare say he wouldn't say no to a cup of honeyed wine. Here, boy, give that gold cup a good rinsing and offer it to my guest, and tell him that I drink his very good health." Everyone awaited the result with intense curiosity. The huge cup was handed to me, and without pausing to consider whether it would be wise to drink, I screwed up my mouth, pretending to lick my lips in anticipation, and drained the cup at one gulp, though in the leisurely style of an experienced drinker. A storm of applause and a general toast to my health. My enraptured host sent for the two brothers and undertook to pay them 4 times the price they had given for me, after which he put me in the charge of a well-to-do freedman of his, to whom he was greatly attached, and begged him to treat me with all possible care. This freedman showed me tenderness and humanity, and did his best to improve the good opinion that Thiasses already had of him by teaching me tricks. First, he taught me how to recline at table, leaning on one elbow. Next, how to wrestle, and even how to dance on my hind legs. Finally, and this won me peculiar admiration, how to use sign language. I learned to nod my head as a sign of approval, and to toss it back as a sign of rejection. Also, to turn towards the wine waiter when I was thirsty and show that I needed a drink by winking first one eye and then the other. I was a quick and docile pupil, which was not really very remarkable because I could have performed all my tricks without any training at all. But I had been afraid of behaving like a human being without previous instruction. Most people would have taken it as a portent of sinister events, and I should probably have found myself certified as a monster. Then they would have beheaded me and thrown my fat carcass to the vultures. The tale of my wonderful talent spread in all directions so that my master became famous on my account. People said, think of it. He has an ass whom he treats like a friend and invites to dinner with him. Believe it or not, that ass can wrestle and actually dance and understands what people say to him and uses a language of signs. Here, I must tell you, rather late in the day, who Thiasus was. He came from Corinth, the capital of the province of Achaia, and having been successively raised to all the junior offices to which his rank and position entitled him, he was now to be Lord Chief Justice of Corinth for the next 5 years. Since convention required him to live up to the dignity of this appointment by staging a public entertainment, he had undertaken to provide a 3-day gladiatorial show in evidence of his open-handedness. It was this, indeed, that accounted for his presence in the north. He was trying to please his fellow citizens by buying up the finest wild animals and hiring the most famous gladiators in all Thessaly. Now, having found all that he needed, he was on the point of returning to Corinth, quite satisfied with his purchases. But instead of riding in one of his own splendid gigs, some covered and some open, that formed the tail of his long retinue, or on one of his valuable Thessalian thoroughbred hunters, or pedigreed Gallic cobs, he preferred to mount lovingly on my back, saying that he had come to despise all other forms of conveyance. I now sported gilt harness, a red Morocco saddle, a purple ass cloth, a silver bit, and little bells that tinkled as I went along. He used to talk to me in the kindest way, telling me, for example, how delighted he was to own a charger whom he could count as his friend. When we reached the port of Iolcos, we embarked with our menagerie and finished our journey by the sea, sailing along the coast of Boeotia and Attica until we arrived at Corinth, where a vast crowd poured out to greet us. I think, though, that more people were there to see me than to welcome Thiasus. So many visitors wanted to watch my performances that my trainer decided to make more money out of me. He kept the stable doors shut and charged a high price for admittance, one person at a time. His daily takings were considerable. Among these visitors was a rich noblewoman. My various tricks enchanted her, and at last, she conceived the odd desire of getting to know me intimately. In fact, she grew so passionately fond of me that, like Pasiphae in the legend who fell in love with a bull, she bribed my trainer with a large sum of money to let her spend a night in my company. I am sorry to record that the rascal agreed with no thought for anything but his own pocket. When I had dined with Thiasus and come back to my stable, I found the noblewoman waiting for me. She had been there some time already. Heavens, what magnificent preparation she had made for her love affair. 4 eunuchs had spread the floor with several plump feather beds, covered them with a Tyrian purple cloth embroidered in gold, and laid a heap of little pillows at the head end of the downy sort used by women of fashion. Then, not wishing to postpone their mistress's enjoyment by staying a moment longer than necessary, out they trooped, but left fine white candles burning to light up the shadowy corners. She undressed at once, taking everything off, even to the gauze scarf tied across her beautiful breasts, then stood close to the lamps, and rubbed her body all over with oil of balsam from a pewter pot. She then did the same to me, most generously, but concentrating mostly on my nose. After this, she gave me a lingering kiss. Not of the mercenary sort that one expects in a brothel, or from a whore picked up in the street or sent along by an agency, but a pure, sincere, really loving kiss. "Darling," she cried, "I love you. You're all I want in this world. I could never live without you." She added all the other pretty things that women say when they want men to share their own passionate feelings. Then she took me by my headband and had no difficulty in making me lie down on the bed, reclining on one elbow, because that was one of the tricks I had learned, and she evidently was not expecting me to do anything that I had not done before. You must understand that she was a beautiful woman and desperately eager for my embraces. Besides, I had been continent for several months, and now, with all this fragrant scent in my nostrils and a keg full of Diasis' best wine inside me, I felt fit for anything. All the same, I was worried, very worried indeed, at the thought of sleeping with so lovely a woman. My great hairy legs and hard hooves pressed against her milk and honey skin, her dewy red lips kissed by my huge mouth with its ugly, great teeth. Worst of all, how could any woman alive, though exuding lust from her very fingernails, accept the formidable challenge of my thighs? If I proved too much for her, if I seriously injured her, think of it, a noble woman too. My master would be forced to use me in his promised entertainment as food for his wild beasts. But her burning eyes devoured mine as she cooed sweetly at me between kisses and finally gasped, "Ah, ah, I have you safe now, my little dove, my little birdie." Then I realized how foolish my fears had been. She pressed me closer and closer to her and met my challenge to the full. I tried to back away, but she resisted every attempt to spare her, twining her arms tight around my back, until I wondered whether, after all, I was capable of serving her as she wished. I began to appreciate the story of Pasiphae. If she was anything like this woman, she had every reason to fix her affections on the bull who fathered the Minotaur on her. My new mistress did not allow me to sleep a wink that night, but as soon as the embarrassing daylight crept into the room, she crept out, first pleading with my keeper to let her spend another night with me for the same fee. He was willing enough to agree, partly because she paid handsomely, partly because he wished to give Thyasis a novel peep show. He went off at once to Thyasis with a detailed account of the night's events and was rewarded with a large tip. "Splendid, splendid," cried Thyasis. "That's the very act we need to liven up our show. But what a pity that this sweetheart is a noble woman. Her family would never allow her to perform in public." Advertisements circulated in the brothel districts of Corinth failed to find any volunteer to take her place. Apparently, no woman was abandoned enough to sell what remained of her reputation even for the generous fee that was offered. In the end, Thyasis did not have to pay anything. He got hold of a woman who had been sentenced to be thrown to the wild beasts, but would, he thought, make a suitable mistress for me. We were to be caged up together in the center of the packed amphitheater. You listen to me, your host, Norman Douglas. Good night, Norman. I'm reading from The Golden Ass, translated by Robert Graves, written by Publius 1900 years ago. I'd already heard the woman's story many years before this. The father of the little boy who afterwards became father of the little boy who afterwards became her husband, had set out on a long journey, ordering his wife, who was expecting another baby, to kill it as soon as born, but only if it turned out to be a girl. It was a girl, and not having the heart to obey orders, the wife asked the neighbor to bring the child up for her, and on her husband's return, told him it was dead. When the girl grew to marriageable age, the mother could not give her the dowry to which she was entitled by birth, or not without her father's knowledge, so she decided to take her son into the secret. She had another reason for doing so. The girl did not know whose daughter she really was, and what if her brother, by bad luck, fell in love with her and tried to seduce her? Now, the brother was a good-natured man, and felt obliged to obey his mother and behave as a kind brother should. He kept the family secret dark, and to all appearances, what he did for his sister was merely an act of common charity. He gave her a home in his own house and let it be thought that she was an orphan without a legal guardian whom he had decided to marry off to his best friend. He undertook to find her dowry himself. This admirable, innocent arrangement somehow provoked Fortune to behave with more than her usual spitefulness. The brother was already married to the woman whose story I am telling. And her bitter jealousy of the supposed orphan led her in the end to commit a series of crimes for which she was now condemned to be thrown to the wild beasts. She suspected her husband, the brother, of having already made the girl his mistress and of intending to make her his wife. When this suspicion turned to hate, she thought of a very cruel plan for ridding herself of her rival. She would steal her husband's signet ring, go for a visit to their country house, and from there send a slave to tell the girl that the husband wanted her to visit him there as soon as possible and without escort. The slave, who, though faithful to the mistress, was otherwise an absolute rogue, would show the girl the signet ring as a proof that the message was urgent and authentic. The girl was anxious enough to obey her brother, for she knew now that he was her brother, as no one else did, and the signet ring had the required effect. She hurried out all alone to the country house, and there ran into the trap laid for her. She was set upon with sadistic fury, stripped naked and flogged till she was nearly dead. The poor girl was forced by the pain to reveal the secret. "He's my brother. He's my brother," she kept on sobbing, but she was wasting her words. The sister-in-law paid no attention to her, dismissing the story as an invention, and finally snatched up a blazing torch, which she thrust between the girl's thighs so that she died in agony. The brother and the friend, whom the girl was to have married, heard the terrible news of her death and fetched the corpse home for burial, each lamenting over it in his own way. The brother took the news hardest, for his wife was the last person in the world whom he could have wished to be a murderess. He took to his bed in such anguish of mind that brain fever set in and his temperature rose so high that nobody expected him to recover unless with the help of some very powerful drug. Now his wife, who had long since forfeited the right to be so called, then went to a doctor well known for his gross lack of professional principles. He had already murdered several patients at the request of their relatives and privately boasted of his successes, offering him 600 gold pieces for an instantaneous poison. When he consented, the wife came back and told her husband that he must drink a medicine known to eminent physicians as the sacred potion, the effect of which is to ease gastric pain and carry off bilious secretions. Really, of course, the potion mixed for him was sacred not to Apollo, the god of healing, but to Proserpine, the goddess of death. The whole family was present, several friends and relatives as well. when the doctor came in with the potion, stirred it well in its cup, and offered it to the sick man. But the murderess boldly decided to get rid of her accomplice in this new crime and at the same time save herself the expense of paying him. As the sick man was about to accept the cup, she restrained him. "Doctor," she said, "I feel it my duty as a wife to insist on your having a good taste of this medicine yourself before giving it to my dear husband. I want to make certain that it contains no poison. I'm sure that so learned and so careful a man as you are won't be offended by my request. I make it only as a matter of form." The doctor was so surprised by this bloody-minded woman's self-assurance that on the spur of the moment he could think of no excuse for refusing. If he showed the least fear or hesitation, everyone present would suspect him of poisoning the cup, so he was forced to take a good swig. The husband confidently followed his example and drank what was left. That was all for the moment, and the doctor wanted to hurry home before it was too late for an antidote that would counteract the effects of the poison he had taken. But she was bent on completing her infernal work and would not let him out of her sight. "You must stay here until the poison has begun to work," she said, "and we can judge of its effect on my husband's health." She didn't say poison, she said potion, until the potion has begun to work. She wasn't blowing her own cover, sorry about that. He begged to be excused. He protested against his unwarrantable detention. But by the time she had agreed to let him go, the poison was already playing havoc with his intestines. He managed to struggle home in excruciating pain and had only just enough time before he died to tell his wife what had happened and ask her at least to collect the stipulated fee for the poisoning. And that was the end of the celebrated doctor. His patient succumbed soon afterwards, and the murderess wept long and deceitfully over the corpse. A few days later, when the funeral rites at his tomb had been completed, the doctor's widow came and asked for the fee, pointing out that two murders had been provided at the price of one. The murderess remained true to character. In the friendliest tones and with a convincing show of good faith, she answered that of course she would pay the money, if only she could have a little more of that same mixture to complete the business she had begun. The doctor's widow was taken in, declared that she would be delighted to oblige, and knowing that the murderess was a wealthy woman, tried to get into her good books by running home at once and fetching her the whole case of poisons that had belonged to the late doctor. With this perfect armory of crime in her possession, the wife prepared to go in for murder on a large scale. She had a little daughter by the husband whom she had just killed, and felt piqued that the child, as next of kin to the father, would inherit all his property. She wanted it all for herself, now that she had taken legal advice and discovered that, whatever their moral character, mothers always come in for the reversion of legacies bequeathed to their children. In fact, she showed herself as bad a mother as she had been a wife. When she invited the doctor's widow to breakfast and slipped the poison into the food she was about to eat, she also gave a dose to her own little girl. The child choked and died almost at once. And the doctor's widow, when she felt the dreadful poison working her intestines and began to feel difficulty breathing, realized at once what had happened. She rushed off to the home of the governor, calling aloud for justice and declaring that she had some terrible crimes to reveal. A big crowd supported her, and the governor granted her an immediate interview. She told him the whole story from beginning to end. Then, her head dizzied, her mouth closed convulsively, she ground her teeth and fell dead at his feet. The governor was an able and experienced officer and decided to allow no delay in bringing this hateful woman who was accused of killing 5 people to summary justice. He sent for her female slaves at once, tortured the truth out of them, and on the strength of their depositions, sentenced her to death. Doubtless she deserved a still worse fate than merely to be thrown to the wild beasts. Still, this was the most appropriate sentence that occurred to the governor at the time. WGXC.org, WGXC 90.7 FM, broadcasting to you from from Main Street in Catskill. As performed in the promo earlier, just before the show, donate monthly. Keep this station thriving. WGXC.org. You listen to me, your host, Norman Douglas, the name of the show, Good Night Norman, the name of the radio station, WGXC.org, on the World Wide Web, most of the rest of the world, WGXC 9.7 FM right here in beautiful downtown Hudson, New York, Catskill, Acre, and beyond. Donate to Wavefarm, wavefarm.org. Okay, the next chapter of this delightful text is called The Goddess Isis Intervenes. From the Golden Ass by Apuleius, and a translation by Robert Graves. This was the woman with whom it had been decided that I should have public connection, a performance which almost amounted to a legal marriage. It was with extreme anguish that I waited for the day of the show. I was tempted to commit suicide rather than defile myself and be put to an everlasting shame by holding bedding down with this wicked creature before the eyes of the entire amphitheater. Alas, I had no fingers or palms. How could I draw a sword with the round stump of my off fore hoof? Only one slender hope remained to console me in my desperation, that the new year was here at last, and wildflowers would soon be springing up all over the countryside, spreading a bright sheen of color across the pastures. And in the gardens, the imprisoned rosebuds would break out from their thorny stalks and open and exhale their delicate scents. One taste of rose leaves, and I should be Lucius again. The fateful day came at last, and I was escorted towards the amphitheater through cheering crowds at the head of a long procession. During the first part of the performance, which was devoted to ballet, I was placed just outside the entrance, where I was glad to crop some tender young grass which I found growing there, raising my eyes curiously every now and then to watch the performance through the open gate. By way of prelude, a number of beautiful boys and girls in rich costumes were moving with dignity through the graceful mazes of the Greek Pyrrhic dance. Sometimes different streams of dancers would weave in and out of the same circle. Sometimes all would join hands and dance sideways across the stage, then separate into four wedge-shaped groups with the blunt ends enclosing a square space. Sometimes there would be a sudden divorce of the sexes, the boys and the girls separating from each other. Presently, the trumpet blew the retreat to signal the end of these complicated dance movements, and the backdrops were removed to disclose a far more elaborate performance. The scene was an artificial wooden mountain supposed to represent Homer's famous Mount Ida, an imposing piece of stage architecture, quite high, turfed all over and planted with scores of trees. The designer had contrived that a stream should break out at the top of the mountain and tumble down the side, and a herd of she-goats were cropping the grass. A young man strolled about, supposedly in charge of them, dressed in flowing Asiatic robes with a golden tiara on his head. He represented Paris, the Phrygian shepherd. Then a handsome boy came forward, naked except for a rich cloak worn over his left shoulder, and between the strands of his long yellow hair one could see two little golden wings. These wings, with the serpent rod and the herald's wand that he carried, showed him to be the god Mercury. He came dancing towards Paris, and after presenting him with a golden apple, explained Jupiter's orders in sign language, then retired gracefully. The next character to appear was Juno, played by a girl with very fine features, a white diadem on her head and a scepter in her hand. Then Minerva came, running in, easily recognized by her shining helmet with its mantling of olive leaves, her high-lifted shield, and the spear that she was brandishing as if about to fight someone. She was followed by another girl of extraordinary beauty and such an ambrosial complexion that she could only be Venus, Venus before marriage. To show her perfect figure to fullest advantage, she wore nothing at all except a thin gauze apron which inquisitive little winds kept blowing aside for an amorous peep at her downy young thighs, or pressing tight against them so as to reveal their voluptuous contours. Her body was dazzlingly white to show that she had descended from heaven, and her gauze apron was blue to show that she would shortly return to her home in the sea. Each of the girls who played the parts of these goddesses was escorted by her own attendants. Juno had two young actors with her, representing Castor and Pollux. I guessed who they were by their helmets, shaped like the halves of the eggshell in which they were born to their mother Leda, and with spiky stars painted on them, the constellation of the twins. Juno advanced calmly towards Paris, to the sound of gentle flute music in the Ionian mode. Her short, confident nods were an assurance that if he judged her to be the most beautiful of the three, she would make him emperor of all of Asia. Minerva's attendants were two young men, representing terror and fear, who danced a fling before her with drawn swords, and a bagpiper who followed behind, playing a battle march in the Dorian mode. The deep braying drones contrasted with the shrill screech of the chaunter, which stirred the dancers to ecstasy, like the trumpets called to battle. Minerva herself joined in the fling, tossing her head from side to side, her eyes gleaming like daggers, and her quick, excited writhings promised Paris that if he gave the verdict in her favor, she would help him to become the bravest and most successful soldier the world had ever known. Then in came Venus, smiling sweetly and greeted with a roar of welcome by the audience. She advanced to the center of the stage with a whole school of happy little boys crowding around her, so chubby and white-skinned that you might have taken them to be real cupids flown down from heaven or in from the sea. They had little wings and little archery sets, and, this was a nice touch, all carried lighted torches, as if they were conducting their mistress to her wedding breakfast. In came a great crowd of beautiful girls, the most graceful graces, the loveliest seasons, who strewed the path before Venus with bouquets and loose flowers, propitiating her as queen of all pleasures with the shorn locks of spring. Presently the flutes broke into sentimental Lydian airs. The audience was charmed when Venus began dancing to the music with slow, lingering steps and gentle swaying of her hips and head and hardly perceptible motions of her arms to match the flautist's delicate modulations. Her eyelids fluttered luxuriously or opened wide to let fly passionate glances, so that at times she seemed to be dancing with her eyes alone. As soon as she came before the judge, she promised with tense gestures that if she were preferred to her rivals, she would marry him to the most beautiful woman in the world, her own human counterpart. Young Paris gladly handed her the golden apple in token of her victory. Well, then, you lowest of the low. Yes, I am referring to the whole legal profession. All you cattle-like law clerks and vulture-like barristers, are you really surprised that modern judges are corrupt when here you have proof that in the earliest ages of mankind, in this first court of law ever convened, the simple shepherd, who had been appointed by Jupiter himself to give judgment in a question that was troubling heaven and earth, succumbed to a bare-faced sexual bribe, which was to prove the ruin of his entire family, and sold his verdict in open court. No, sirs, and you will recall a later precedent when Agamemnon, the illustrious commander-in-chief of the Greek armies before Troy, condemned the wise and learned Palamedes to death as a traitor, though fully aware that the charges against him were false. You will also recall his judgment in the dispute between Odysseus and Ajax as to which of the two was the bravest. He knew that Odysseus's courage could not always be depended upon, and that Ajax was by far the better man, yet he gave judgment in favor of Odysseus. As for those famous lawgivers, those brilliant intellects, those eminent scientists, the Athenians of the classical age, what sort of a verdict did they give in the case of Socrates, whose wisdom was commended by the Delphic oracle above that of all living men? Am I not right in saying that by the treachery and jealousy of a wicked clique, he was found guilty of corrupting young people, though the truth was that his philosophy was directed towards bridling, not inflaming, their passions, and sentenced to die by drinking the poisonous hemlock cup? This has left an indelible stain on the reputation of Athenian justice, because even today, the best philosophers, those who aspire to the highest form of human happiness, regard his system as the most truly religious of all and swear by his name. Okay, forgive this outburst. I can hear my readers protesting. Hey, what's all this about there? Are we gonna let an ass lecture us in philosophy? Yes, I dare say I'd best return to my story. As I was saying, Paris gave his verdict. Then Juno and Minerva retired from the scene. Juno in sorrow, Minerva in rage, each of them expressing in dumb show her indignation at not having been awarded the prize. But Venus danced for delight with the support of all her attendants. Then a fountain of wine mixed with saffron broke out from a concealed pipe at the mountaintop, and its many jets sprinkled the pasturing goats with a scented shower so that their white hair was stained the rich yellow traditionally associated with the flocks that feed on Mount Ida. The scent filled the whole amphitheater. Then the stage machinery was set in motion. The earth seemed to gape, and the mountain disappeared from view. After this, a soldier ran along the main aisle and out of the theater to fetch the murderess, who, though condemned, as I have already explained, to be eaten by wild beasts, was destined first to become my glorious bride. Our marriage bed, inlaid with fine Indian tortoise shell, was already in position and provided with a luxurious feather mattress and an embroidered Chinese coverlet. I was not only appalled at the disgraceful part that I was expected to play, I was in terror of death. It occurred to me that when she and I were locked in what was supposed to be a passionate embrace, and the wild beast, whose part in the drama would be to eat her, came bounding into our bridal cage, I couldn't count on the creature's being so naturally sagacious, or so well-trained, or so abstemious, as to tear her to pieces as she cuddled close to me while leaving me alone. While Thyasis was busy inside the cage, putting the last touches to the bed, and the rest of his household staff were either admiring the voluptuousness of the scene or getting things ready for the hunting display which was to follow our interlude, I planned my escape. I had such a reputation for tameness and gentleness that nobody was keeping an eye on me. I edged towards the outer gate, which was quite near. Once outside, I bolted off at top speed and went 6 miles at full gallop until I found myself at Cenchreae, the most famous of all Corinthian boroughs, which is washed on one side by the Aegean Sea and on the other by the waters of the Gulf of Corinth. Cenchreae has a safe harbor and is always crowded with visitors, but I wanted to keep away from people. I went to a secluded beach and stretched my tired body in a hollow of the sand, close to where the waves were breaking in spray. It was evening. The chariot of the sun was at the point of ending its day's course across the sky, so I too resigned myself to rest and was presently overcome by a sweet, sound sleep. Not long afterwards, I awoke in sudden terror. A dazzling full moon was rising from the sea. It is at this secret hour that the moon goddess, sole sovereign of mankind, is possessed of her greatest power and majesty. She is the shining deity by whose divine influence not only all beasts, wild and tame, but all inanimate things as well, are invigorated, whose ebbs and flows control the rhythm of all bodies whatsoever. Whether in the air, on earth, or below the sea. Of this I was well aware, and therefore resolved to address the invisible image of the goddess, imploring her help. For fortune seemed at last to have made up her mind that I had suffered enough, and to be offering me a hope of release. Jumping up and shaking off my drowsiness, I went down to the sea to purify myself by bathing in it. 7 times I dipped my head under the waves. 7, according to the divine philosopher Pythagoras, is the number that suits all religious occasions. And with joyful eagerness, though tears were running down my hairy face, I offered this soundless prayer to the supreme goddess. Blessed Queen of Heaven, whether you are pleased to be known as Ceres, the original harvest mother, who in joy at the finding of your lost daughter Proserpine abolished the rude acorn diet of our forefathers and gave them bread raised from the fertile soil of Eleusis, or whether as celestial Venus, now adored as sea-girt Paphos, who at the time of the first creation coupled the sexes in mutual love and so contrived that man should continue to propagate his kind forever, or whether as Artemis, the physician sister of Phoebus Apollo, reliever of the birth pangs of women now adored in the ancient shrine at Ephesus, or whether as dread Proserpine, to whom the owl cries at night, whose triple face is potent against the malice of ghosts, keeping them imprisoned below earth. You who wander through many sacred groves and are propitiated with many different rites, you whose womanly light illumines the walls of every city, whose misty radiance nurses the happy seeds under the soil, you who control the wandering course of the sun and the very power of his rays, I beseech you, by whatever name, in whatever aspect, with whatever ceremonies you deign to be invoked, have mercy on me in my extreme distress. Restore my shattered fortune. Grant me repose and peace after this long sequence of miseries. End my sufferings and perils. Rid me of this hateful four-footed disguise. Return me to my family. Make me Lucius once more. But if I have offended some god of unappeasable cruelty who is bent on making life impossible for me, at least grant me one sure gift, the gift of death.